GSF 90.1 FM, जो कि बर्नबी ब्रिटिश कोलंबिया में स्थित है.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, feed your head, Grace Slick cried out in the song White Rabbit. How about feeding the bacteria in your gut?
I like the saying, we are what our gut microbes do with what we eat. Often people say we are what we eat, but I think we are what our gut microbes do with what we eat.
Beer won't make you smart or healthy. How about wine purchased at the hospital?
Riesling, Pinot Gris, Gewürztraminer, Sylvaner, Pinot Blanc, Pinot Noir, Pinot Auxerrois. And we do have some special grape types. We do have a very specific appellation that's called Klevener de Heiligenstein, so it's a little bit difficult to say. And we also have a Grand Cru that's a very typical Grand Cru because it's Le Grand Cru Käferkopf.
And recalling the Birmingham campaign for civil rights 60 years ago.
What happened that day? Kids thrashed about by German shepherds, hit with fire hoses. Those fire hoses could dislodge mortar from brick, could strip bark from trees. It effectively scalped kids, burns from the water itself. These images were what Jack and Bobby Kennedy saw.
Before diving in, a request. Help us deliver this weekly package of Earth News. Subscribe at greenplanetmonitor.net. You are what you eat, so they say. As it happens, the trillions of bacteria living in your gut eat what you eat and turn meals into molecules that boost your health and spirit, if you feed them well. I spoke about the gut microbiome with Janelle Healy. Healy specializes in the influence of dietary fiber on gut bacteria. She's a registered dietitian and a researcher at the University of British Columbia. What is the gut microbiome?
So the gut microbiome is a collection of bugs or microorganisms that we have in our gut, and that's made up by bacteria, viruses, fungi, and various other microbes.
But mostly bacteria?
Mostly bacteria, and most researchers do focus on bacteria, but I think there's a lot to learn about how fungi and viruses and archaea may affect our health and well-being as well.
Well, let's focus on the bacteria. How many bacteria are in our gut and where specifically are they?
So there's probably hundreds of species of bacteria that live in our guts. We have classified and characterized quite a few of those bacteria, but they are quite hard to study because they are anaerobic, which means they can't be cultured in oxygen. So you need to have special equipment in the lab to be able to study them very well. And so most of the bacteria that's in our gut is in our colon. So that's the more distal or lower end of our gut.
That's the large intestine.
The large intestine, that's correct. But there is some bacteria in the small intestine, and some researchers are trying to study the small intestinal bacteria as well, because they think that that's probably important to not just the bacteria in the large intestine.
So we've got 10... something like 10 trillion of our own cells, and roughly, I gather, 100 trillion, so 10 times as many, mostly bacteria on us and in us, but mostly in us. So, well, you know, if there's 100 trillion of them, there must be huge numbers in our gut.
Yes, exactly. And some people recognize the bacteria or the microbes in our gut as being their own kind of organ. And they produce a lot of metabolites and components that have a huge influence on how we as humans function as well. And so we really need to take them into consideration when we are thinking about our health and well-being.
Like if you look at feces, the dry weight of feces, most of it is bacterial. Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong. That's correct. So we shed the microbes in our gut as well. So when they replicate and die, we will shed any of those microbes out in our feces. And so using feces is, is a way that we can study the gut microbiome too.
Now, this is amazing. You just said like the gut microbiome is almost like another organ. It's got a structure and a function.
Mm-hmm, that's correct.
And it's essential for our well-being. Talk a little bit more about that. I mean, what do all these bacteria do? Most of them are good guys, quote unquote, but there are some bad actors in there. What do the good guys do?
So the good guys have a lot of different functions in our body. They can utilize substrates that we can't. For example, the fiber that's found in our food. We as humans don't have the enzymes that can digest fiber. And so fiber will reach the large intestine where bacteria can ferment those fibers. And during that fermentation process, we produce metabolites such as short-chain fatty acids, which are known to have various health benefits. Also, the commensal microbes or the good microbes in our gut will help ensure that any pathogenic or bad microbes can't establish themselves in our gut as well. So they outcompete those microbes so we don't get infections. The microbes in our gut also help to train our immune system. So we have a strong immune system so we can fight off various inflammatory conditions as well. And also some microbes can produce vitamins that we can use as humans too. So they have a lot of really important functions within our body.
And they produce chemical compounds that have an impact on the functioning of our nervous system, on our brain, do they not?
Yes, that's correct. The microbiota can have an impact on our brain function and our memory. They can help us produce dopamine and serotonin, which affects our mood, anxiety, and depressive states.
How do they do that?
So they produce metabolites or chemicals that have an effect on our production of serotonin and dopamine, and then they can travel to the brain and cross the brain barrier and, yeah, impact how our brain functions.
Huh. And so our mood is influenced by the gut microbiome. I have people who suffer from inflammatory bowel disease, of course, it's awful. It's who wouldn't feel bad with that kind of condition? But I gather that there's a certain, it isn't just feeling crummy, right? These guys are actually producing chemical compounds that are affecting our mood.
Mm-hmm, that's correct.
Talk about butyrate.
Yeah, sure. So I don't know much about the effect butyrate specifically has on the gut-brain axis, but I do know that there is a link between butyrate and the brain. But butyrate has so many different functions within our body outside of just the brain and also outside of our gut. And so within the gut, butyrate can help prevent a leaky gut. So that's where the cells that line our gut, the barrier between them becomes more weak. And so components from within the gut can leak through into the underlying it's called the lamina propria, and that's where all our immune cells for our gut sit. And so if you have a leaky gut, those contents shouldn't be reaching those immune cells. And if they do, that can lead to inflammation. Also, butyrate is known to have an effect on our blood glucose levels as well. It can affect how the pancreas functions, has an impact on insulin sensitivity, and whether our blood glucose levels stay normal. There's also a role of butyrate in protecting against various cancers, particularly colorectal cancers, and that's just to do with cell replication. And also butyrate is known to help dampen down inflammation as well. So it can increase the numbers of anti-inflammatory immune cells that we have in our body. So it's generally considered to be very beneficial for our health because of all of these key functions that it has within our body.
And bacteria produce them.
There are specific microbes that will produce butyrate, and butyrate is produced by those microbes in the presence of fiber. So the more fiber that you have in your diet generally will lead to higher butyrate productions as well. And so that's a lot of the research that I do is around trying to find fibers that will enhance the number of butyrate producers and lead to increased butyrate production.
Talk about that. What have you learned about the kinds of fiber, nutritional fiber that people consume that promotes, that's good fiber, quote unquote, that promotes the production of butyrate and that bacteria are happy with, and versus fiber that they just can't deal with?
Yeah, so there are different types of fiber, and some of the fibers are fermented very well by the microbes in our gut, whereas other fibers don't ferment very well. So one example of a fiber that doesn't ferment well is cellulose. And so cellulose is found in lots of different foods that we consume, but microbes generally aren't able to ferment that fiber. Whereas fibers such as fructooligosaccharides, inulin, resistant starches, they are known to help increase the levels of butyrate producers and increase the amount of butyrate that we produce within our gut as well.
I mean, the cellulose is just good roughage, right? I guess it just kind of helps, gives our gut some exercise.
Yes.
But what kinds of food products contain these good fermentable fibers? Where would we find these good fermentable fibers in our diet?
So with fructooligosaccharides and inulin, they're found in a lot of whole grain foods, also in garlic, onions, artichoke, bananas, that type of thing. And then with resistant starch, you find them in potatoes, bananas, etc. as well. So it's really important to try and consume a good number of fruits and vegetables, whole grains, nuts and seeds. And I think it's pretty important to not just focus maybe on those fibers, but trying to focus on eating a large variety of different fibers, because different fibers will feed different microbes. And it's been shown that it's beneficial to have a large variety of different species of bacteria in your gut. And so to ensure that you're feeding those species adequately, you want to have a good variety of different substrates in your diet as well.
So Grace Slick wrote, feed your head. You're talking about feed your gut microbes.
Yes, exactly.
Forgive me, I was just listening to White Rabbit the other day. So, I mean, this is interesting. So, I mean, bacteria are metabolic factories. They are structurally simple, but incredibly virtuosic metabolically, and they can do lots of different things. There's all sorts of diversity amongst the things these little guys can do. And so we've got, what you're saying is we've got that's an advantage. We got to play that up and give them the diverse diet that suits their diversity.
Yes, exactly. And there's a concern at the moment that the westernized diet that a lot of people consume is essentially starving the microbes within our gut, because a lot of the nutrients that are within a Western diet have been shown to lead to detrimental shifts in the gut microbiome. Those diets are generally very low in fiber, high in sugar, high in fats. And so a westernized diet is generally considered to not be helping our gut microbes thrive. And so having more plant-based diets, a Mediterranean diet, diets that are variable with a mix of different food groups seems to be more beneficial to our microbes, because it allows us to feed them with the substrates that they need.
So we can kind of culture our microbes. We could participate in their goings on, can't we?
Yeah, exactly. We're a little petri dish where we can kind of experiment with ourselves and our diet and how that makes us feel as well. There are signs and symptoms of whether your gut microbiota are happy with regards to how your gut is feeling and how your mood is. And so, yeah, if you feed them well, they will look after you as well.
Huh. What's the difference between prebiotics and probiotics?
So the difference between pre and probiotics is that a probiotic is a live microorganism. So that will be a live bacteria. So, for example, lactobacillus or bifidobacterium. Whereas a prebiotic is the substrate or the food component that feeds the live microbes. So, for example, the fructooligosaccharides, inulin-resistant starch that I discussed earlier.
So these are called, these are prebiotics.
Yes, so your fibers would be considered prebiotics. There's a specific definition where you can only call a food component a prebiotic if it is known to modulate the gut microbiome and lead to health benefits. So it has to satisfy those two criteria. And so, yeah, you need to ensure that it's modulating the microbiome, but also has a positive impact on us as humans as well. And so there are only a few fibers that can be technically classified as a prebiotic, but there are a lot of potential prebiotics that are coming through as well.
And these are commercially available. You can go into a health food or nutrition store and buy things that are labeled prebiotic?
Yes, you can. But they're also found in the foods that we eat as well. And so again, supplements are fine, but they are just that particular prebiotic. Whereas if you eat prebiotic-rich foods, you're getting various other nutrients and vitamins, etc., from those foods. And it's possible that the combination of nutrients and vitamins are important to the microbes as well.
So those are the prebiotics, and we've got the probiotics. You want to talk a little bit about probiotics?
Sure. So a lot of research has been done into the effect probiotics have on the gut microbiota composition, but also on our health. And so there's been mixed results between studies about whether probiotics are actually beneficial or not. And one of the areas that a lot of people are focusing on at the moment is whether probiotics can actually engraft or establish themselves in your gut after you stop taking them. And it's generally believed that once you stop taking a probiotic, that bug or microbe probably can't stick around within your gut because all the other microbes in your gut have already established themselves in there. They have their own little niche. And so it's something that a lot of research is focusing on at the moment to try and increase the likelihood of those probiotics being able to establish themselves in your gut.
Do you know anything about fermented foods, like fermenting foods and consuming fermented food and dairy products of their various sorts and types? You've, of course, always got to be careful that you're not going to get botulism, doing it carefully and safely and eating fermented foods in order to replenish or support your gut microbiome. Talk about that.
Yeah, so fermented foods have gained a lot of popularity recently because of the proposed health benefits that they have. Fermented foods have been around for centuries, and people generally fermented foods to help preserve those foods. But what we're starting to understand is that the process of fermentation means that there are probiotics or live microbes that are within those foods that we will be consuming if we consume the fermented foods. Also, the microbes that are involved in that fermentation process will produce chemicals and metabolites that then we ingest if we consume those foods as well. And also, a lot of these fermented foods also contain prebiotics, so the substrates that the microbes will use for fermentation. So there are a lot of various components within fermented foods that may have impact on our health and help to kind of dampen down inflammation and alleviate some diseases. But most of the research done on fermented foods hasn't been done in humans. And so we need to generate a lot more research in this area to actually figure out the mechanisms behind why these foods are so beneficial and which foods, fermented foods, might be the best for which particular diseases. I like the saying, we are what our gut microbes do with what we eat. You know, often people say we are what we eat, but I think we are what our gut microbes do with what we eat.
Janelle Lunken-Healy is assistant professor in the Division of Gastroenterology and Nutrition at the University of British Columbia. Read more about Janelle's research at greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, subscribe. With your generous help, we'll keep delivering stories about planet Earth, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. Of bacteria live in your gut. What you eat, they eat. Gut microbes enjoy a balanced diet with lots of fiber, fresh fruit, and nuts. They also enjoy good drink. How about alcohol? It's a question science has been grappling with and debating for years. Of course, moderation is always best. Is a glass of red wine or two actually good for your health? Or will it send you to the hospital? Here's a story about going to the hospital to buy wine. Standing in a doorway inside the grounds of Strasbourg Civic Hospital, it's one of France's oldest medical institutions, as large as a small town, with a staff of over 10,000. In the basement of the hospital's administration building, something most hospitals don't have, a wine cellar. A highly reputed and well-stocked wine cellar. Here, the finest wines from France's Alsace region are available at a reasonable cost. Strasbourg Hospital's historic wine cellar is a tourist destination, and you don't have to buy wine. You can just wander through the cool, dimly lit cellar, gazing at giant oak casks, reading about how Strasbourg Hospital got into the wine business 600 years ago. Paying for healthcare was what it was all about.
Hello!
Hello! Thibaut Baldinger, the cellar's director, explains.
This cell has been created because you had only 10% of the people that were healed in the hospital that could actually afford to pay their healthcare in gold. All the other ones, they were actually forced to pay with animals, sometimes houses, sometimes lands, or sometimes vineyards. And that's why the hospital became one of the biggest vineyards owner and landowner of the whole Alsace region.
Thibaut leads me into the heart of the cellar.
It's nice and cool down here.
Absolutely.
Groundwater levels are high in Strasbourg. So, like the city's famous cathedral, this wine cellar is built on a solid foundation.
Here's actually the historical heart of the cellar, and that's the first stone, so the pillar over there that was laid in 1395. And so under each of these pillars, you have around 15 trees that are between 4.5 to 5 meters tall. They're shaped like crayons, and they are put one after another. Fondation sur pilotis. And so that's really typical from Strasbourg.
A few steps away, a humongous oak cask lies on its side. It's empty now, but once contained a vast quantity of red Burgundy wine.
26,000 liters, so 34,000 bottles of Pommard inside that barrel.
It just makes you smile.
Absolutely. Have a nice weekend, though.
Down a long corridor, there's plenty of wine that can be imbibed, produced by 27 vintners from across Alsace.
Riesling, Pinot Gris, Gewürztraminer, Sylvaner, Pinot Blanc, Pinot Noir, Pinot Auxerrois. And we do have some special grape types. We do have a very specific appellation that's called Klevener de Heiligenstein, so it's a little bit difficult to say, but that appellation is the only place in Alsace, so the small town of Heiligenstein, where you can find this wine. And we also have a Grand Cru that's a very typical Grand Cru, because it's Le Grand Cru Käferkopf, and that's a Grand Cru located in Amerschwihr. And with the Grand Cru Käferkopf, it's the only blended Grand Cru. So you have 60% of Gewürztraminer and 40% of other grape types.
Sticking out of each cask, a shiny spigot that opens with a key.
We've got a key that's opening the tap, and this key is called the Paradise Key.
Paradise Key.
Because you can actually open the paradise that's inside.
Alsatian vintners have paid for these casks to be refurbished, but the hospital's wine cellar is a money-making business. Storage costs must also be covered.
We can't ask them to pay one more time because they already paid for the renovation of the barrels. So we actually thought, well, they're going to pay us like in 1395. They're going to pay us in nature good. And so in French, we've got a French expression that says liquid money.
This is where the cellar's wine shop comes in. A small percentage of the wine maturing in these casks will be bottled for sale. Some physicians are uncomfortable with the arrangement, Thibault says. Still, fine wine is prestigious in France, none more so than the 540-year-old wine stored at the very end of the cellar.
An old, very old Alsatian white wine. And this wine is a wine from 1472.
1472?
Yeah.
Behind a locked steel gate, 400 liters of the precious fluid sit tranquilly in a specially built oak cask.
And so here we are.
A visit to this medieval treasure is the high point of cellar tours.
Inside of this barrel is the wine of 1472.
What's going to become of it? Will it be bottled?
Oh, no, no, no. It's just this wine hasn't got any price. We can't do any pricing because it's just like it's the only one, it's the oldest one that's kept in an oak barrel.
So it's like one of those incredibly expensive bottles of wine that you buy, you get for your wedding that you never drink.
Well, even more, because there's not enough space on the credit card to put zero to buy it, and the hospital don't want to sell it.
Strasbourg Hospital's enological treasure is too acidic to drink. But you can smell the cork, a thick wooden plug, actually.
Oh, that smells very nice.
A little bit like haze, a little bit like hazelnuts, fruit liquor, vanilla, maybe smokiness also. Woody, obviously, because the wood is just very young. And that's what's really typical, because you also got a little bit of freshly cut herbs.
Nearby, something most tourists don't visit.
I'm just looking for the keys.
First, we cross a room filled with bottled wine sitting on shelves.
It's a room that's closed to the public, actually, because it's now our wine storage room.
Smells nice.
Behind another locked door, the cellar's darkest secret.
So right here, so that's the second dissection room, and the first one is just over here.
Here, hundreds of years ago, human corpses were dissected by doctors and students.
In this window, you had corpses that were falling from, and then they were getted on a table and then opened to see how the human body was working.
These days, Strasbourg Hospital and its medieval wine cellar work hand in hand on much more pleasant activities.
It looks like a Crémant.
Yes. And that's our house Crémant, that we call it. La cuvée des hospitaliers.
Annual blind tasting to see which wine ends up getting finished here takes place in January. Until then, Strasbourg Hospital's historic wine cellar is open to visitors from 8:30 in the morning till 5:30 in the afternoon, Mondays to Fridays, Saturdays till noon.
Merci beaucoup.
Merci à vous.
Read more about the wine cellar at Strasbourg Civic Hospital at greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, subscribe. For as little as $5 a month, you'll be helping to make this weekly news package happen. Darker story. In the annals of racist terrorism, few acts were uglier or more cowardly than the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama, 60 years ago on Sunday, September 15th, 1963. 19 sticks of dynamite blew out a hole 2 meters wide in the 80-year-old church's back wall and a half-meter deep hole in its basement. 4 young girls were killed. I spoke about Birmingham Sunday and the civil rights activism that led up to it with Paul Kix. Kix is the author of a new book called You have to be prepared to die before you can begin to live. 10 weeks in Birmingham that changed America. Hello, Paul Kicks. Welcome to the Green Planet Monitor.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
You've just